second place his first day. He struck a hang, like, tore the whole boat up.
Okay, Jeff, I know.
Putting Corporal Tom Kelly boards. He said, I don't know what it was, but it didn't give. Tore his drudge up, tore his chop roller up.
Chop.
We're good?
Good.
Okay, and you've got all the staffs ready? Ready to get started? Okay, great. I'll let you start, Rob, with introductions and announcements.
Appreciate you showing up on a, has it been a nice day? Because I haven't been outside yet, so I hope it was a fairly nice day for some.
Yeah, rain and foggy over home, but it didn't clear it up.
It was.
I was in a tunnel all day long today.
I can't have everything. Tomorrow, 78
yeah.
degrees, though, so stay tuned.
Yeah.
This morning, I'll do so.
You know, this is a time where it may be, look as if it's not as critical as other meetings. So, for example, you know the winter dredge survey results will be back, we hope, late April this year rather than early May. You know that our planning horizon that we've developed now for a couple of years is July to July. So the next time we look at regulatory changes for blue crab, it's going to be in advance of the July meeting. It could be May. You know, we'd like that in May because then everyone has fair notice of what's coming along the way. So those are some things to keep in mind. Right now, a big part of tonight, after Joe presents sort of a review of 2015 and what went on in the fishery, is this allocation issue. And I know we talked about it one other time. Allocation is something that no one seems to want because it's difficult to imagine. I know here at BMRC, haven't asked recently, but our law enforcement division has said allocation to track a quota would be next to impossible. There are so many different places that you can land crabs. How on earth is law enforcement supposed to be able to keep up with that? Maryland has different reasons, but I've certainly heard them be skeptical of allocation. Potomac River Fisheries Commission the same way. So having said that, I think we should all realize that in government, there are sometimes things that happen that are beyond what we think should happen. There's an implementation committee for Chesapeake Bay that includes the governors. And in 2018, the jurisdictions are supposed to have a plan, at least, to review an allocation plan, not to put in place allocation, but to have a plan that can be looked at. And there has to be a determination whether it's feasible, practical, necessary, all of those things. So all we're going to be doing up until, you know, late into 2017, for the schedule we'll go over later, is we're going to be trying our best to make sure that if there is a, you know, allocation, and if there's a total allowable catch spread among the jurisdictions, that we have something that we think is fair in Virginia. I've stated before, I think the wrong way to go about this is to say, you know, we want to make sure one jurisdiction gets the shaft and we don't. That's never going to work. I think the jurisdictions themselves, that, you know, who are involved, the managers, are going to have to sit down at some point with the feedback of different advisory committees and the public and say, well, this isn't ideal, but it won't kill us. Will it kill you? I mean, that's what you call negotiation. Now, once we go through all that, it may be by 2018 that there's still not a total allowable catch and there's still not an allocation. But, you know, we certainly think at BMRC that we have to be ready in case there is. And so that's why I sent you that information the other night. And we're going to talk about that after Joe gives his presentation about what's going on with what's called the work plan towards allocation, essentially. And I think that you know, some of you have been involved with blue crab issues for a long time, and, you know, I think at least we're capable of a large group, staff and the committee, in developing something that will make sense in terms of allocation. So that's really all I have to say, Madam Chairwoman.
Thank you. Okay. We'll move ahead. We do have a quorum, so we need approval. We'll start off with the June 25th, 2015 meeting.
I'll make a motion to pass the minutes as written.
Do we have a second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? And we also need approval of the January 5th, 2016 minutes.
Make a motion to approve as submitted.
We have a second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? And move on to new business. And I believe Joe has a presentation.
Let's start with new here to get this out of the way. Night for discussing allocation, but we thought people would be interested in a harvest update. Most of the numbers are in now. Really don't expect these numbers to change much. So it's just kind of a busy table, but I like it because it has a lot of information on there. So this isn't this is just crab pot harvest for Virginia, and we've got the pounds, the number of trips, and the number of harvesters that were active in each month. So we've got 4 years laid out, and you know we know that total harvest has been down overall the last few years. 2015 looks like it's right around 22 million pounds for crab pot. So back over the 20 million mark, which is you know probably a good place to be. 2015, if you spend some time looking at these numbers, it's a bit of a flip-flop from 2012, where we had a great spring in 2012, and then the rest of the year kind of fizzled out. This was a year where we started off slow, not surprisingly, with the winter we had going into it, and then had a real strong fall. So, like I said, very busy table, so I'll give you guys some time to look if you have any questions. And then I'll move on to the peeler pot harvest.
Any questions?
Okay. Why do you like, I have one question. Why do you like having the trips in there? What is the significance of that?
Well, it's interesting to see how much effort's being put into getting that amount of harvest. Mm-hmm. You know? So in lean times, you're not going to see a lot of people show up, but even with the number of people, sometimes, you know, there's people that this fishery is truly how they make a living, so they're going to be going out whether or not, you know, crabbing is great. So it's always good to know kind of that pounds per trip ratio to mm-hmm. get an idea of effort. So. Peeler harvest will be over 1 million pounds for 2015. Peeler harvest has been fairly consistent. There were a few years back where we had a period where we were closer to 1.5 to 2 million pounds, but it's been a good 10 years where we've been 1 million pounds.
I think this might tell us a little bit because the last couple of years it's picked up, and especially in 2015 had a truncated season, so that's when the shorter season was in effect. And I think one of the things we look forward to, and I hope we talked about a little bit tonight, talked about a little bit last time as well, is, you know, we made the season a little bit longer for the current regulation that goes through July. So April 21st starts. fewer pot season and any other year except for crab pot. And September 25th was the cutoff in 2015 for those same year types. And if you remember, the most flack we heard was from both ends of the bay. So the Western Shore wasn't too pleased about the late opening, and the Eastern Shore was definitely not pleased about the early closing. And so one of the things to consider, it's going to happen, it's going to come up, is what should be done, what should be the advice to the commission if abundance is up compared to where it's been the last several years. The last good, really good, solid year of abundance was 2010. 2011 wasn't too bad, but the winter die-off in Maryland. So, but 2010 had 215, really more than 215 million H1 crabs and a good crop of juvenile crabs. So I think as we go forward, I hope you'll think that by the time we get winter dredge results, some ideas about, assuming the numbers are good everywhere. You know, there's been a lot of talk about the numbers being good in Virginia. Maybe a little above average in Maryland. I mean, that's the word on the street.
Down your neck. So I'm going to go down your neck.
We can do. What we have to keep in mind, I think everyone has to keep in mind, is are we going to reach sustainability all at once? If we haven't really had a good, solid year since 2011, all of a sudden this year it's a good, now I'm not forecasting here, but it's a good abundance. Is that sustainability? Is that, you know, open up the faucet as much as you can? Or is it, you know, you really, everyone talks about 3 years. 3 years you see the same trends. That starts to show sustainability and abundance. And we know the exploitation rate's been low for 6, not 7 years. But that's been challenged, by the way, and we'll talk about that when we get to the handouts that I'll give you. The exploitation rate has been challenged by the CBSAC members as to what does it really mean that you're under the exploitation rate. So we'll talk about that. We can bring that up when we bring up these documents. Okay?
Thank you.
I have a question. Can you go back and just flip through the last two slides quickly? Okay. So on this one, pick June of 2015, 8,000 trips out of 600 people, so that means they went 12 times on average during the month. Does that seem, I just don't understand. I thought full crabbers went every day.
Or what you end up with as an average is dealing with part-timers and full-timers. And you
but part-timers, don't they set their gear out and work it every day, more or less, or at least every other day?
I mean, in the summer, you think you
I mean, in June, they'll die. June or July, for sure, they'll die.
But how many people are in and out?
But how many people will pull their pots up, you know, half the month?
Well, one of the other things you got, okay, so one of the other things you have to realize is when we try and show active harvesters, we show everybody on a vessel. So if you have.
But that makes, oh, okay, so that makes the statistics go up, okay.
So you have more people with less trips because you've got two guys working together. They've only got one trip limit, you know. They're only coming in with that one trip. So
that could easily double these numbers.
It certainly has a part. Yeah, we know a lot of guys work together, even if they've only got that one vessel limit. So this is, you know, since we had those changing dates, we've got three different seasons with three different closing dates. 2016 for the fall closing is highlighted in red because that's something where, you know, we were expecting to address later on since we're doing this June to June or July to July management strategy that we would get to what will be the season closure date, not just for peeler pot, but for all other gear other than crab pot. So that's something that needs to be discussed, I think. And we've had three different season openings, and we've had three different season closings, but we've, and the openings with 2013 staying the same, and you can see how that's impacted harvest. Got started later in 2015, you know, but again, with a good fall even for the peeler harvest, and then what it meant at the end of the year, and then, you know, Rob had mentioned what the later part of the season means for Eastern Shore Tangier specifically, and we'll see that with some of the other gear types too, not necessarily crab pound, but I was thinking like crab scrape where they were able to harvest later than they have in the past few years. So scrape seems to be the one part out of all the other gears that 2015 wasn't necessarily a strong year. Don't know if that had anything necessarily to do with the seasons or not. And I kind of blew by the crab pound, but and kind of in the reverse order, you know, 2015 seems to be a better year for crab pound.
2016 has November 30th only because when the regulation is done, it's only done through July. So that regulation has to be taken up again, and November 30th may or may not stand depending upon your advice to the commission and staff advice to the commission. So it was September 25th, 2015, September 15th, you can see it up there the year before. Where will it be in 2016? I think that depends a lot on, you know, the abundance trends that we see.
And that's, I mean, that's really the update for 2015. As we go through with some of the allocations and stuff, I've got kind of where, you'll see where that kind of fits in compared to, you know, historically, not just the more recent years. You know.
Any other questions for Joe? Thank you, Joe. Is there any other new business? I believe we might have someone in the audience, Mr. Jenkins.
Yeah. I'm going to come through tonight.
That would be great.
I can get that on a holiday. I would like to say, I read in the National Marine Fisheries, and I don't know why them's robbing them, don't know. But they've already forecast a good survey from the dredge season, with abundance of in each size crabs, close to a million more than it was last year.
I read the same thing.
And we're not going to know anything until May. How did they get that? Where did they get that? I don't know. Okay.
National Marine Fisheries.
Yes, it was in there. I read it myself.
I have an inside track.
Don't let it on something somewhere. But anyway, my point is this. I think the penal fight industry was cut so bad from 300 pipes to 210, 220. We should increase that to at least to 250 and have the season open at least a week earlier this year. What really helped us, the area that we fish in the Rappahannock, last year was a cold winter ahead of that, and the croakers didn't show up in the creeks along the Rappahannock on the like farm and around the creek and them. Usually they there in March, last March, and they didn't show up till last of June last year. So that helped the small crabs in the creek fish two or three times before they went out the main stream of the river. And that had been a big factor in the number of small crabs. Also, the catfish, for some reason, those stayed up here in the Rappahannock. My son and I, we fished that crab pot for years, the penal pots, and we'd catch 3-4 bushels of catfish a day. Last year, I think for over a month, we had caught but 8 catfish. Not 8 bushels, but 8. And Roger Hawkins back there with him. He fishes pounds in the creek. And the croakers and the catfish run in there, and those crabs shed it during April and May. Then when as the water temperature rose, they went back out in the river. So we had, even now with the lack of spots that we normally fish in the short season, I mean by cutting, starting late, we still had, you know, a good catch. Because the crabs were there. Most catch crabs got to be there. They're eating up before they become mature crabs. You don't get them. And that's the point I'd like to make.
Thank you, Mr. Cox.
Yeah, I have a question for you. Do you think the water temperature, what was the reason why you didn't, when it warmed back up, did you catch catfish then? And the croaker show up as the water temperature warmed up?
We didn't caught any catfish in the mountain until crabs moved further on up the river, and the catfish, for some reason, stayed up there. And a lot of times they down the freshness of it or whatever factor they play in it, I don't know. I know the pound nutters up there that catch tons and tons of catfish, they had a good season.
Well, the reason I asked my question, when you said you know, the year before that you were catching a lot of catfish, and then last year you didn't.
8, 10 years.
So what else I'm thinking, you're saying that you like to have the season opened earlier. So, like I say all the time, geographical locations is a big deal. Just because you open in one area, it's too cold in another area. So that may be the problem. The season, if you want the season to open earlier, maybe that will help that.
And
it's all based on water temperature and geographical location, always. I say this all the time, you know.
I agree with you. Yeah. I just feel, you know, we're not going to have the survey results in time to open the season early.
We had it tonight, you know, so they could come up before the board.
Yeah. But he made a very good point. I read the same thing in National Fisherman that the winter, they had the winter dredge survey.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll have results in time
and if that goes through and won't act on that till next year, see, we'd be high.
Yep.
That's one thing we can look into. One thing that might be a possibility is extending the season on the other end. I know that affects different people.
Won't help that early wrong now.
I know.
Thank you for trying.
It'll help someone in another area.
Yeah. And then I will move back just so you can see that we do have it adjusted so that 2016 will be earlier than 2015 was, but you know, any other adjustment to get in time for the commission meeting. But it is, we did already move it a little bit back, that so the opening is going to be April 21st for 2016 instead of May 1 as of right now. Just wanted to point that out.
Thank you,
Madam Chairman.
Yes,
questions.
I'm sorry, Mr.
Yeah. We go through this every year with this survey taking so long to get us the results, and we have to either postpone or we make an inappropriate decision. When do they finish their actual work?
Last Tuesday.
And so, that's kind of why, that's our latest attempt at addressing that was to go with the July to July management, and that's why we adjusted April for 2016 already.
Right.
We haven't discussed the November part of it, but you know, those tweaks that Doug is talking about right now, we're still in that situation.
How is it that somebody else can get the information and they only finished working last Tuesday? I didn't get any.
I'm just finishing up Virginia's portion of the database right now. Then it goes to Maryland when they're combined, and then it's calculated.
Well, is Maryland releasing some preliminary numbers on their end?
They're not finished yet, as far as I know.
Yeah.
I mean, it never finishes before the
How long does it take you to compile the numbers at the end? I know you're not involved in that part of it.
I take care of the Virginia portion of the database, and I should be finished with that by the end of this week.
Oh, is that right?
And I'll send that to Maryland. And
who knows where it goes up there?
I have no comment on the rest of it.
So say by the third week of March, usually every year, you can pretty much have a general idea of our end of the bay anyhow. No?
That doesn't come out until the statewide estimate. I mean, Maryland's numbers have to go in.
No, I'm just talking about our numbers. So you're finished with your numbers. Today's the 15th. So give it another week.
Then I would have everything in form for them to combine and calculate.
Okay. Well, that's just a benchmark for us to keep in mind anyway.
Well, the problem with the numbers calculations to do, and I think what happened, this data was released April the 8th or so back in 2008 because the governors were involved. Everyone went into this hurry-up offense to get the numbers out. There was a big press conference with Governor Kane, Governor O'Malley, and everything else. Since then, what has been found out that rushing leads to mistakes, and that's why a couple of years ago, it was into early May before we received everything. Part of the problem is, although Maryland has a huge staff compared to us, they really rest most of the number crunching and analysis on one person. And then, you know, we start to see some things, they start to see some things, and that's part of the process. But as far as who's seeing what, I mean, I get calls, they say, we're seeing this. Well, that's what they see in their areas, okay? You see trends in your areas. That's the report. I get a call from someone up in the northern part of the area who says, hey, they hear Maryland has a little bit more than last year. You get calls from Virginia. Until we see the numbers worked up, we won't know.
Thank you, Rob. Any questions? Additional new business, and maybe you can help me with this, Rob. Discussion on biodegradable panels and possible incentives to use them.
Right. So, Commissioner Bull, right before your last meeting, was asking that the committee look at the use of biodegradable panels and crab pots. And the reason he's doing that is the one thing that I know for sure is that the commissioner has an ear to the General Assembly, and he's been doing that since 2007, I guess, something like that. And he's been approached by a couple of legislators, from what he told me, who seem very interested in biodegradable panels. And what John Bull, what his concern is if there's not some step forward to try them out in Virginia, that there's going to be some legislation. I don't know how strong that is. You know, John seems to, since he's brought it up a few times, he certainly thinks it's strong. So the idea that John's proposing is that there could be some incentives which, you know, Lynn and I talked about this briefly, but we aren't really sure what those incentives might be. They're going to have to come from the commissioner as to if you're able to use the biodegradable panels or test them out, however you want to do them, that might afford some incentive. And I think that's what would have to be talked about is what those incentives are. So are they... A, you know that we had the extended season in 2012 and 13. It does favor the southern part of the bay. You know that. But nonetheless, I think it was very welcome to those who participated in that fishery. And, you know, maybe it goes longer than December 15th. You know, Pete will remember, because I certainly do, and I think it was 1994, harvesters came to the commission on two separate occasions, and the season went into the second week of January, the crab pot season. You know, that hasn't happened since. There's also the incentive about the pots. So, for example, we heard from Doug about getting back I guess the idea is that when 2008, when the crab pots were reduced, it was reduced by 30% along with the peeler pots. And then the commission came back and did a half measure. They only reduced the crab pot by 15%. So there could be some incentive there. But for the crab pot, it might be a situation, I know I've heard from a few people, even this past week, not this week, but the past week, when are you going to give us our pots back? You know, when do I get my 300 pots instead of 255? So that may be an incentive. I think on top of that, and I'm not saying this for any other reason, I've heard it from some of you, a lot of the harvesters already use more than their allotted pot amount. So would they consider that an incentive? They may. It may be good for someone to know they have a legal 300 pot limit that they can fish, as opposed to, you know, having illegal pots out there. And who knows one day, because you know what? We've got a case before the commission coming up where the Marine Police found that one person had 277 pots for a 255 pot license. And I know the industry at times says, you can't pull all those pots. Well, they did. And this fellow didn't hide them in other areas or do enough, so he'll be before the commission. So, you know, maybe there is some incentive to having the pot limits back where they were. Those are two I can think of, and I think the committee might think of some incentives.
Mr. Powers?
Rob, are you looking for incentives for individuals to test the program, or are you looking for incentives for the industry to make this change?
I think we have to start out with testing.
So that could be a research program with VIMS that you pay someone for their reporting as part of the deal.
I don't know how that works without thinking about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thing.
Yeah.
Mr. Moore?
There have been a number of tests, though. I mean, Ty Farrington has talked with some of us in the past about he was testing these with VIMS already. So it seems to me we're maybe not at the full-scale pilot, but we're past very basic testing on this. And I don't know. Maybe Kirk Havens would be a good person to come talk to us.
Well, the testing, I mean, it depends where you are, too. Mm-hmm. Geographically, in the bay, it makes a difference on how pots get scurfed and everything else. I
mean, right.
I know that. But, you know, it could be more than just isolated individuals. You want to get as many areas as you can. You want to get as many interested harvesters as possible. And I still think we're back talking about the incentives, not now so much, because first, I think that we'd like to hear your thoughts just in general on moving to something like this, you know, in steps.
Mr. Nixon?
What are you going to consider biodegradable, something that will corrode or something that will dissolve in water? Because what you're going to run into is salinity levels between, say, the mouth of the James River and further up. You know, you go further up the rivers and zinc anodes don't even work very well like they do in full salt water, and different people have tried aluminum and everything else. So if you put say a non-galvanized panel or a thinner wire galvanized panel or something, it was going to go away at the lower end of the bay, and further up in the rivers it's going to remain longer. That's what I was wondering. I
can't claim to know enough. I know Kirk Havens did have a little publication that I had last time around. It sounds like Chris may have some ideas.
Yeah. Kirk and his staff and some other folks have been working on a lot of it. They're different polymers that they would use, and it's not a wire. It is a polymer based, and they've worked on everything from fish traps to actually they're even looking at producing shotgun shells that dissolve the shot wad at this point. So it's a polymer type product that they've developed, and my guess is they're at the point where they know lower.
Well, they've tried in oyster aquaculture, you know, different vegetable-based plastics, mm-hmm. you know, for bags that will use for netting that you that will just decompose after a while and go away. Is that the same type of product? Or
I don't know exactly what the feedstock is to make it, but I would say it's very similar in that it's a I think it is a vegetable-based product, although I'm not 100% sure about that. But it is something that, yes, it will dissolve after a period of time.
We'll bring you what we can dig up for next time.
Yeah. Well, let me make another suggestion before I lose my turn here. Two of us here are on this Fisheries Resource Grant Committee that maybe that might be a way to get some of these products tested mm-hmm. without it being an expense to anybody but the money that's already allocated for things like that.
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Thompson, Mr. Cox.
A couple questions. I guess the first would be the cost of the panel. And, if you had volunteer watermen to be willing to do it, you know, what would it cost them, to buy the panel itself, or would you, give them to them? And my second question would be, when we put escape rings in, they generally last as long as the pot does, so it's not something you got to, continue to replace every year. So the panel, my biggest concern would be how long would the panel last? If you put it in the spring, have I got to take it out and replace it again before the fall, using the same pot? Because some pots will last 2 or 3 years. So my question, that'd be my main question. Yeah. How long would this, if the panel is going to last 3 years, and I don't see any good in it to it. You understand what I'm saying? So, every year we go through our pots, and a lot of times, the wire comes untwisted, but it rings that, and we'll fix that. But that would be my main concern, what it would cost. And if it was a voluntary thing and you voluntarily gave us the panels, I think you wouldn't have any problem getting individuals to voluntarily use it based on how long it's going to last. Because something that I've got to put, like bar zinc, like Pete was saying, the bar zinc sometimes will last, all year. If a river, you put it in over on the seaside in salty water, you got to replace it 2 or 3 times. So if you had to replace this panel 2 or 3 times, I don't think you'd get many people that wanted to do that. It would at least have to last a season out.
From what I understand, the cost is around $1 per piece, and the lifespan is approximately a year from what my understanding.
Chris, do you know more?
No, I don't know any more about the product they're developing there. I would just say, in relation to this issue, obviously the General Assembly weighed in on a crab pot issue this session without a tremendous amount of consternation. And so I think Commissioner Bull's thinking is right that they would not be surprised to find them weigh in on something like this in the future.
Mr. Tanker?
Well, what's the reason for it, though? What is Bull saying? I mean, it seems to me on the Eastern Shore, at least, we see one specific problem where people just decide to leave their pots. Every zone has a person who...
lost. So, I mean, the first work by VIMS, you remember the ghost pots?
Right.
Marine debris recovery program and the ghost pots and everything else. And I mean, I might be off base, but based on what I've heard over the years, a lot of pots are lost each year.
Sure.
And they act as traps for, many different types of species. And I think the idea is that, if they degrade, they're not going to be a trap. And I think that's the fundamental reason.
It will allow crabs, fish, and turtles, and that kind of stuff to escape. Once it biodegrades, the hole will be bigger. The coral ring's this big, so anything bigger than that can't get out. So if you put an escape panel in, it dissolves. Other creatures could get out of it.
So we should, and I know there's some anxious staff members who want to dig up information, so we'll do that for you. And then, it would seem common sense that if we're willing to do...
I'm laughing about your anxious staff members.
If we're willing to do, a situation where there's some who will put it in voluntarily,
yep.
That's certainly... that can't be anything but good.
Well, the whole matter was when you mentioned the commissioner, when he takes interest in something... I've been here a long time. When the commissioner takes interest in something, you need to be thinking about that.
Yeah, well, when he talks to me before every crab,
And Rob, I know we spoke about this earlier, but my comment, I guess, thinking a little bit differently, is whether or not these would hold up to the pressure washing and the abuse, depending on where the pots are set. They can be brought in several times for pressure washing, and I don't know if they would hold up to that.
Yeah, and they must at least through one or two, but I don't know long term. So. Yeah.
One.
Well, I believe if you make, they establish a time of decay based on the thickness of the panel. So you make it a little bit thinner if you want a smaller time frame, a little bit thicker if you want a larger time frame.
That was the question I was going to ask. What sort of time frame was anybody looking for? Did you have any? I know this is very preliminary. Mm-hmm. We're talking about this for this panel to decay after the pots lost 3 months, 6 months, 9 months.
It's my understanding it was a year.
Yeah, season. I can go along with the season thing from spring till fall.
Yeah.
Then replace. You know, have to replace it. Madam Chairman.
Well, I use galvanized pots myself, and if I don't put a zinc on them, they won't last that long. The whole thing will disintegrate.
They'll be gone.
Mr.
Cox? Mine won't last that long with two zincs on.
Well, I guess the main question is, Rob, is it the same size as a coal ring?
I haven't seen
it. I mean, if it's bigger than a coal ring, then everything can get out.
No, you wouldn't expect that.
Yeah.
The mesh size has to be pretty small.
Well, the mesh size is small, but the ones they have looked at are larger than a coal ring, but it obviously mimics the wire until it degrades. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. Okay.
Yeah.
It's a ring, but it's a...
Okay.
Okay.
All right, don't hit the button. Just pass it around.
You might have to tap the screen occasionally.
Right. Keep tap the screen if it goes on. All right.
So, you know, we'll have more later, and it's encouraging to hear that, you know, we just can look forward to some participation, and we'll go from there.
I know one of these skate rings.
I see how big they are. I mean,
the longer they stay in, the more crabs grow out of them.
That's supposed to be.
The more they get clogged up?
No, they get bigger. They wear down.
The more crabs grow out of them, they get bigger.
Yeah, they wear down.
Where's that plastic?
Yeah.
I don't know if it would wear that.
Yeah, well, crabs, fish, everything does that when they go through there.
You're going to make me think back to what was called the morphology of crabs. Marshall remembers that when we did the coal ring experiments and tried to figure out the sort of the, not just the width, but the length of crabs that can go through coal rings and all that.
If you use the same coal ring over 3 years, it gets a lot bigger.
Yeah.
You'd be surprised.
Makes sense.
Yeah, can all the crabs go to that fish, go through the area, everything.
So a question about these rings. So I take it the outer ring is made much thicker and lasts a lot longer than the middle stuff?
I believe it is.
So, I mean, so that it stays in, yeah. So that way your pot won't get trashed as early.
Makes sense. You'll have some more information on that at our next meeting, Rob?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Before we move on, there's one question in the audience. Was my understanding it was about a dollar a pot.
But we stopped talking about pot bag and we said it was too expensive at 17 cents a pot.
Well, the pot tagging, it wasn't the 17 cents a pot that Billy Wallace mentioned. It was the administrative cost. You can't have a pot tagging program without having at least one. I want to say it was about well beyond the tag. You know, tag, we can find the tag. Love to have it, though.
Thank you, Rob. Moving on to old business. Continued discussion on allocation-based management framework of the Blue Crab resource in the Chesapeake Bay between the three jurisdictions.
Yeah, that way it's more.
I gotta bring my glasses. I can't see all this little right.
I've got one. I don't know. Yeah, we should be good.
There's no way in the world I see that.
That makes sense, wouldn't it? Either. Good deal.
So, I just received this information that I handed out yesterday.
Well, I'm glad because I was fixing to fuss with you.
Yeah, and I sent it to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. To you by email.
Yeah.
And it's not all that informative, but it there are some interesting things here. It is part of the allocation situation, and I'm just going to touch on some things here that you should probably know about. The first page is talking all about the stock assessment. So there has not been a stock assessment. This is the analytical approach where they take all the data, and they take the data from the winter dredge survey. They take the harvest data from all the gears all through the bay and all that. And they come up with a health index, essentially, with the stock assessment. You know, is it overfished? Is overfishing occurring? Those type of things. The important thing is that there was a lot of rebellion about the stock assessment. And this has been dragging on for months. So the original price tag, which I wasn't rebelling against that as much, because I didn't know where the money was going to come from anyway, but the original assessment had a very high price tag. And not only that, it seemed to be doing a lot of things that my counterparts in Maryland and PRFC wondered, was it really necessary to do all of that? So I can tell you one of the weakest parts of the last assessment was it was through 2009 data. The assessment was finished in 2011. It set the targets that we have now, the 215 million spawning age females. It set that, and it also set an overfished limit, 70 million crabs, which a couple years ago we were down to 59 million, if you remember that. That was a cause for a lot of consternation everywhere. And on the overfishing part of it, it's 34%, above 34% of the stock being removed, that percentage, then you're starting to impact the reproductive capability if this goes on for a little bit, for a while. The target's like 25.5% removal. Well, when they did the 2011 assessment, they determined from all the data that only 40% of the age zero crabs, right? This is like rehearsal now again. The crabs that are less than 2.4 inches carapace width, those are the zero crabs or recruits. And they said the dredge surveys only accounting for 40%. So when they do the exploitation rate or the removal rate, they're dividing whatever they have for those juveniles by 0.4 for 40%. And what's really contested right now is that may have been fine for 2009, 8, 7, all the way data back in the past, but is that good for now? And every year,
can you depend on these zeros or small crabs to be distributed the way they were when this data was worked up? And there's a lot of skepticism in the Bay jurisdictions about the exploitation rate because of that. Because after all, if you when you see the data, you see that we've been very low on exploitation rate, but where's the harvest? Is it all effort? Has effort dropped out so low that the harvest isn't up Bay-wide 70 million pounds, 60 million pounds? You know, it's been just a couple years ago, 35 million yeah. pounds for the entire bay, but the exploitation rate's fine. So there are a lot of questions about that. That stalled the assessment.
Well, that's easy to explain.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is.
Yeah.
We've lost so much picking infrastructure, yeah. and the way the fisheries changed, it moved out of the main stem of the bay largely and moved upriver. So you don't have that large quantity of females that we used to have being put on the market
right.
the whole season. You'll see them in the spring when there's some value to them, and then after the sanctuary areas close, you've run everybody out of the bay, but there's not but so much market for that product anyway, and everybody moves upriver where you probably catch a few less pounds, but the value of the product is appreciably higher. Whether it's peeler crabs, you know, for the soft crab market, or the larger or even number two males, there's more of a retail market for those, where your females, other than Asian markets, are, you know, would go to picking houses. And that's
half the equation. So Maryland has a better infrastructure and more males, and that's the and they still have been down. 2010, I think we were about 90 million pounds bay-wide. And, you know, to get back down to 35 million a year ago, I mean, that's really substantial. But the males is what we all should pay attention to, because that's the other part of the assessment. We have wanted the assessment team to get a reference point for males, just like they do for females. Overfishing, overfish for males. And they've always come back and said, no, that would be too confusing for managers, and you don't want to have two reference points, and it really caused trouble. Well, we want something better than what we have, because 2 years ago, it was the lowest amount of males in the survey that we have seen since 1989. The lowest. So I think it was like 25 million males. So don't think for 1 minute that, you know, what's good for one is good for another. We still need to pay attention to the male harvest as much as Maryland pays attention to the female harvest. I mean, it's just natural the way the distributions are. So the assessment, we hope, will treat that. The third thing the assessment should treat, it came up tonight already in talking to Mike, it's hoped that they'll do a spatial analysis where they will look at Virginia and look at Maryland. PRFC will be joined in with Maryland data and come up with information we can use that way, because there has to be better ways than what we've been doing all these years, which is just essentially lumping everything together. And then when you look at the data, I looked at data earlier today, you can't really make sense out of it because it's bay-wide data. These reference points, you know, the overfishing and overfished, are for the entire bay. So how do you relate that easily to Virginia harvest unless somehow you have an idea of what Virginia reference points are? So that's something we'll see about. But the main idea is the assessment will take place. No one has any money. But I don't think NOAA has any money. I don't think we have very much money. Maryland DNR said they don't have any money. Sooner or later, there'll be an assessment, but it's probably going to take some time. It may be 2018 before we see a finished assessment. And I think it was important to let you know about that. In the meantime, The Chesapeake Bay Stock Assessment Committee, CBSAC, that you've heard about, will be the committee to look at this winter dredge survey results, the harvest results. I hope they look at catch per trip and other indicators and can get filtered out from the information like Tom was pointing out, to filter that out so they get a sense of what kind of statistics might be there. And then they'll come up with management advice. And that's been going on since 1997, really at a very rudimentary basis back then, and it keeps getting better and better. So CBSAC will have some good advice for us. On page 3 of the documents you have, it starts to talk about accountability. And there has been a big push in Maryland, which goes back 5 years, I think, where there were two groups working with Maryland, the Environmental Defense Fund, and then this, they have a team which is composed of industry folks, but also agency personnel. And there was a big push to get accountability from the harvesters. The latest turn of that is that EDF, you know, long ago in Maryland, was out of the picture. And this team has continued. You have a one-page sheet that I handed out to you that tells you a little bit about the management team for DNR. And the situation is that Maryland came down here, I don't know how long ago, 7 months, the first time, came down here, and what they want to do, they've had a test program where they got up to about 150 or so harvesters who were using apps on smartphones to report the harvest. And our IT folks met with them, and Eric Park and Todd Sperling in this agency, and they more or less were polite, but they said, you know, this is not going to advance anything. We are already beyond that approach, that it's not the apps, it's the electronic reporting and what it takes to go through those reports. Because some of you may or may not know, it's harder to go through an electronic report in a lot of cases than it is for the paper copies that the data company loads for us and gives back to them after we screen before we send them out. So the electronic reports can be very time consuming to get squared away. And so what we said was, well, we really need help in the form of an FTE, a person who can be doing that work, and, you know, someone else maybe to do some outreach and get more buyers reported and get more harvesters reported. And that will continue. We're still hoping that that continues, that we do a little bit more of that. The problem with accountability is, can anyone tell me exactly, if you have an iPhone or a smartphone, or you have a computer, or you have iPad, or if you have a piece of paper, which one makes you more accountable? Because the message from Maryland is that the smartphones make you more accountable. And I think they do, and I apologize to Maryland, but they really do think that this will be sort of industry-wide, and not just crabs, that it'll eventually wind up that everyone will have the ability to report in that way. They want them to hail in when they're going to start. They want them to hail out so that they could meet them at the dock. Do you know how much money it would take to send someone around to meet more than just a handful of people at the dock to make sure that what they've just reported is accurate? I mean, in concept, it's fine if there were millions of dollars. I mean, in concept, it's fine. So that's what this accountability is all about. From our part, we could do better on accountability. There's no doubt about it. We need to educate the harvesters better than we've been able to educate them, which is usually they get to stand before the commission for failure to report, or they call us, and we have to call them 2 or 3 times to say, no, that's not what you put on your report. You have to put this. There has to be improvements there, and we're aware of that. I think a big issue for us is allocation, which we're talking about with blue crab, but that's with all species. We have like nine, I'm just doing that off my top of my head, Joe can tell me if I'm wrong, nine quotas we have to manage. Does that sound right? Okay. And how many of those quotas would have been better for Virginia if we had better reporting? I mean, think about it. The ASMFC has a lot of votes, but 15 states, and when it comes time to share the resources, just like American Eel, where we got the shaft on American Eel because we didn't have the reporting we needed. If there had been better reporting, we wouldn't end up facing, if a quota is put in place with eel, we get 78,000 pounds. We've been harvesting about 105,000 pounds the last few years. So these are the kind of messages that I hope you and we can convey as we go forward, because that's accountability. Accountability has rewards, and we need to find out where those rewards can be given. So most of this on page 4 and 5 are places where, if you got that email, they said, look at the yellowed area. You can't tell the yellow area in your copy because I did black and white, but it would have been on your printing screen. It looks to me on page 4 that there's just been some wordsmithing. But in general, the Maryland group, they wanted to make sure from their design team that accountability and total allowable catch were separate. They weren't lumped together in this document. And they also had a place which is pretty interesting, where they want to make sure, and you'll see it in the next document, that the idea of having a plan to review for allocation, we should also be saying, or not, that maybe there will not be anything to go forward. Which you would think, I thought about this a little more, but you would think that if all the jurisdictions get together and the allocation plan, they don't like it, there's still somewhere else in government that might say, well, we think allocation is a good thing. And so by saying up front now, because these comments are going to go in, that it may not happen at all, you know, that at least helps out that process at the end. Unless you think allocation, and I don't know, I haven't asked anybody, but so far most in the jurisdictions don't think allocation is going to be feasible for many reasons. What's the data we're going to use? We're still going to have to go through all this. But what's the data we're going to use? How do you seek fairness? What do you do about the male-female sex ratios in the jurisdictions? What do you do about law enforcement? How can 25 at the most enforcement officers in any one day out there be able to keep up with a quota? So we'll move here really quickly because I've taken up a lot of time with this. But I just got it yesterday. You have a one-pager here with something on the back, maybe. This is the design team, and they more or less reinforce, you know, the ideas that they want to make sure that allocation is separate from total allowable catch. I worry about that a little bit because I'm trying to think, if you have a total allowable catch but not allocation, who gets the total allowable catch?
Yeah.
Is it a free-for-all among the jurisdictions? I mean, that's something to definitely keep track of. If there's not going to be allocation, why would there be a total allowable catch? And then also, this is the team from Maryland. We would like to request an additional allocation performance target be added to allow for the possibility that allocations are not feasible. So, and I think at first when I read that, I thought, well, yeah, I mean, but then I thought, oh, okay, that's pretty clever to put that in. So all you have to do if you wish to do anything is, if you look this over and want to put in any comments to me, we'll get them to the goal implementation team. Anything you see. So we'll add that.
Any questions? Comments?
I have a couple of suggestions.
Mr. Cox.
I have one question on this. On the very first page, I mean, we were talking about finances a while ago. What is this cost TBD estimate, $400,000, plus Merlin, DNR, BMRC, POFC, staff time? Second, the first page on the back.
That's the stock assessment you're talking about?
Yeah.
Stock assessment fund.
Yeah.
The last stock assessment was $783,000. The final price of this probably will be less than $400,000. The last stock assessment was paid from the Disaster Relief Fund in both Maryland and Virginia, $100,000 each, and the rest was picked up by NOAA. NOAA doesn't have that kind of funding, even for the $350,000 to $370,000 price tag. And the time is because the Maryland staff, they do have more people than we have. They've got a lot more people. And they said, we can work up some of these analyses ourselves and save money that way, which is fine.
Do you trust them?
What's that?
Do you trust them?
Do you trust them?
Well, the people I work with, yeah.
Right.
I do.
And you know, they've been known to skew things in their favor.
And my second
years past.
I've got a long relationship.
And my second comment was about the mandatory reporting.
Yep.
It's a shame because some of us think that the more we report, the worse it is. The less we report, the better it is. Have you ever considered, you know, years back we've done it over home different times at Waterman's meetings, and you've been there, Jack's been there. Maybe have some public hearings in the school where maybe you could get the Waterman together and explain to them how to fill this out.
You're tunneling into my psyche.
Hey, I'm good. I've been here a long time. I know you a long time. See, I can read your mind sometimes.
Today, we have a situation where there's $35,000 available as a going-away present from the Environmental Defense Fund. And the commissioner has asked all of us to come up with a plan on how to utilize that for outreach and for other aspects for reporting. And my suggestion so far, and I'm sure other staff are going to have better suggestions, is that for $10,000, we can contract with someone who could very easily know from us what to promote and contact all the Waterman's organizations and set up meetings, and that could last more than one round, too. So I'm with you 100%.
Well, you mean to hire somebody to put the presentation on of how to do it? I think you have staff members and yourself well qualified for that.
We can't, no, because we would have someone that would be very qualified to go out and do that. In our routine, we can't really afford to do that. We did it one time with staff, with Stephanie Iverson and others, and it wasn't that successful because it takes someone who's willing to spend, you know, a few times a week making the contacts, making sure everything's right.
Right, okay.
You need someone who's contracted to do that. That would be their specialty.
Right. But I think that would help.
The money lasts.
Yeah, I think that would help. Because still to this day, every once in a while, I have a problem trying to figure out what I'm supposed to put here and what I'm supposed to put there. The wife's good at it.
Joe wants to say something.
Yeah, I think we would need help. We actually did, since we had one of these panels, too, you know, the Blue Crab panel, we did four. In 2013, we went to Tangier, Rappahannock Community College, Cape Charles, and Hosin, showed the guys how to do the reporting or the online report. Really, they were trying to promote the online reporting, and we just, you know, there was poor attendance, and it's really important to get the word out.
Yeah, well, me
Tangier, there was poor attendance.
Right. me personally, I think you need to target more on
yeah,
the face paper.
Mark was part of the panel.
I didn't realize Mark
was
there.
Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I had all the time actually calling in for some reason. But anyway, yeah, there was a panel meeting in Cape Charles, and I made a suggestion when I was on the panel. Basically, we have to more or less, I hate to put it this way, capture grabbers where they're at the time. And it was a installed there is because basically the crabbers show up there. You know, so I mean, to pay somebody $10,000 to do that, to me seems like the money could be spent a little bit better on different things. You know, I mean, we've got statistics that show where crabbers are crowded. You know, you hire somebody for you know $500, say, hey, can you put on some kind of event? That's my
thank you, Mark.
And to follow up with the online and the e-pads and iPads and all these pad deals, I don't think this beats this hard to beat. A piece of, when you file the mandatory on paper, that's hard to beat. You've got a record; it's kept. You do it on your phone and you keep record out, and you drop it on board, it's gone. Paper stays there with you.
We don't have enough staff to be able to take all the reports and find out. It could be done, but it would take a lot of time and take someone really dedicated to that project to find out which reports were really the sentinel reports that you really felt were accurate. There are accurate reports. I mean, yes, there are.
Oh, yeah.
But there's also inaccurate reports. It would take some time to do that. But that's also one of the things that I've been trying to think about since 1994. You know, I always had this, if I say a dream, you might laugh at me, but I had this dream that there'd be some way that you could tell where accuracy was. And when I did this, I loaded up a separate computer with just crab data. It was so massive, but the trends I saw were that you can see, you know, on a very basic level, you can see that there's some problems with reporting. And, you know, I think that's part of the message that maybe, I don't know whether Stephanie and others promoted, but, you know, this fear that people are going to over-report, I'm worried about the people who under-report who don't report. And if they learn more about this allocation and how important it is, we're probably facing a croaker plan soon, a change in our croaker plan, maybe even spot. And, you know, if we have really good reporting, ASMSC, it's going to come down to allocation. So I'm all set. I think Joe's going to talk about agents a little bit.
I've got one other question, Mr. Nixon.
I'm going to put you on the spot. You and I have talked about this a number of times since 1994.
Yeah.
When this was initially done, I'm the only one in this room that was on the committee set up by a House Joint Resolution from Taylor Murphy to start all this stuff.
That's right.
And the waterman's end of it got shoved through fairly quickly. Most of it was on the saltwater license, and the reporting system was left to be done by the commission. And what we had proposed to the legislature, which was Jim Wesson and I at the time, was for presentation was made in front of the commission, was for a system like Florida has. And we even had the head of Florida's Watermen's Association or Fisheries Association come up here and explain it to the commission. What they had in Florida at the time, this was back before cell phones and an extensive internet like we have now, was they had a basic form for a fish ticket, and they still have it now. And apparently it works real well for them because a lot more folks involved in fisheries down there than we have in Virginia, where you had a three-copy form with all the information on it that was needed, soak times, days at sea, or whatever it might be, species, pounds, whatever. There was three copies. The fisherman got one. The buyer got one. The third copy was sent to their Marine Resources Commission, and that was it. The buyer did all the work. It was your state fish ticket. That's what you got paid with. Most people that are worried about accountability want to know that they get paid for every pound they sold. There's your accountability right there, and those forms go to the state. Now, some of this could be done electronically now if need be. But instead of having how many people report, if this was a buyer or self-marketer system, you would get the numbers you need with a tenth less, not a tenth less, 90% less paperwork involved, and your accountability would go up. The only people you might not capture are the ones that sell a bushel of crabs here or 50 pounds of fish here or there to the public. But if they've got to get a self-marketer's license, and that would be in jeopardy if they got caught cheating, I think you'd pretty much, you know, you'd capture a higher percentage than you're getting now with better numbers and less work. But the whole thing was snatched out of our hands by Jane Webb.
Yes. Yep.
You know, and Sonia Davis. And they came up with the first form we have now that we're still going through, although it's on a long sheet. It was supposed to be something that you could have your hard card. If you remember when we first got their cards, they had raised numbers on it. They wanted to run them through a like an old MasterCard machine, you know, an old charge card machine. And we're still using that same form. You know, it's like, you know, we've still got the Model T. We just did away with the hand crank. I think the whole system needs to be revamped. And it needs to go from harvester to buyer.
Yeah.
And even the code says harvester and or buyer.
Yep.
So, and
this is an earlier conversation that I had with your chairwoman. I had the same conversation with her. I had the same conversation with John Bull yesterday. I've had the same conversation over the years. I never understood, especially at that time, the buyers were, you know, more sold to the buyers. There weren't as many self-marketers back in 1993. But I agree completely. I, for the life of me, I don't know what people were thinking about not going with the buyer back then. Now, for eel, right now, we have a self-marketer permit. You get a permit if you want to self-market, and you report. You get a buyer, you get a buyer permit, and you report. So we could have a system like that. It'll take a lot of work. We have to be mindful of the truck trade. You know, that's always been sort of a thorn in the side. We had to get law enforcement to get involved helping us out with audits there. It could be done, but it will take, you know, it's been 23 years. It will take a group of folks from industry and staff to, you know, really figure out all the downsides, if there are any. Compared to what we've been going through, I mean, I'm just guessing here, and I probably should work up the data because I haven't worked it up recently, but out of 2,900 or so registered commercial fishermen, there's about 1,200 who harvest less than 100 pounds or nothing. So all those green cards did not work. All the telephone calls that staff gets, everything else, it does make you wonder, why. So in the meantime, until something changes, I think we have to go on the route of what Marshall's talking about, get a little bit more understanding and accountability. So at the worst case, if we can overturn the system and get a better system, then a lot of the harvesters, if we reach some of them, they'll be self-marketers and they'll be right in tune. So I don't know where the initiative should come from. First time I talked to the commissioner was just yesterday about it. But I mean, over the years, I've always been kind of proposing that.
Well, I even went as far as about a year ago to get Tom Murray to look this form up to see what they have in Florida. And he looked it up and emailed it to me.
Yeah.
And I was basing this idea on like the automobile business. If you go to a Ford dealer and buy a car, one dealer is going to have a particular buyer's order that he fills out. But all of these things are sent to the DMV, and they go to the DMV, and that's what they print your title with. But everybody's got their own buyer's order. You can buy standard form buyer's orders, or everybody can have their own printed up, but they all have to have certain criteria on them that the Motor Vehicle Dealer Board and the DMV requires. You could do the same thing with this board. You could have basic criteria, and each firm, if they didn't want to have a standard form that they just stamped X Fish Company on it, they could make their own forms that have all the criteria on them. And there's your fish ticket. And if they want to send that stuff in electronically, let them do that. If you say it's easier to have paper copies, throw them all in an envelope and mail them once a month. Then you're going to get them every month from a buyer. And they're a whole lot easier to go check. You don't have to, you got to chase a waterman all over wherever he is, at the boatyard, in the river, you know, on the bay, you know, fixing his truck, whatever. The buyer's got somebody there most of the time, unless it's, like you say, the trucks. And you can capture them all in Cape Charles in the spring.
Well, so tonight we have the same amount of staff that we had in 1991. July 1, we're going to have 3 additional staff. It's really bad because today this will be about the second or third thing I thought of that new staff can be working on. But this is a noteworthy discussion because it really, you know, if you were around, I know you weren't around the commission in 1992 when everything was going forward with the roundtable that promoted the commercial registration license and then the reporting that Pete talked about. You know, it didn't come out exactly as planned. It didn't come out that way. So, you know, I appreciate the comments, and it's on my mind too. I think that's what I have, except Joe.
Quick question for Rob.
Mr. Moore.
How many licensed buyers do we have in the state?
Do you know?
About 500. But
thank you.
You know, there's no set number there. Some individual, I mean, that license is sold. There's trucking licenses that are sold with oyster companies that might have 5 or 6 or
right.
Truck licenses. But, you know, in the crab fishery, it's very different. I hope I'm part of this discussion because I'm on the complete opposite of the spectrum as Rob and Pete on this. I've had those discussions that there's a lot of information that to assume that a buyer could produce to buy from the harvesters and the mods to provide that effort information. So.
Hey, Rob, before we move forward, one question in the audience.
When you talk about these tickets and stuff, crabs, are you considering or thinking about something that would be along the same lines as selling oysters? Like a buyer has to be an animal, and with the crabs would be the same way?
Right now, it's not. So that's a detail to think about. Right now, it's on the harvest for that.
Right.
All right, Joe, you want to move along with
yes, I will.
Discussion on agents?
You know, I will just mention briefly that with the allocation stuff, we do have some of the information now, and Rob was sending you those emails. So, you know, he put out word through the jurisdictions that one of our tasks for 2016 is getting at least the harvest data together for the allocation stuff. So as you've if you've looked through your emails, Maryland and Virginia and Potomac did combine that stuff. So, we did all send in our harvest data, and so I did quickly put together some of this stuff, but, you know, this is just overall harvest for that was reported by in all those busy tables and stuff he has.
Okay.
You can see that overall Maryland is saying that they harvest, you know, this is all gears, all crab harvest, and so with the exception of a few years, they out harvest the other jurisdictions.
I'm sorry, I look at that data and say, no, we're harvesting the same.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's fair. A little more interesting is only if you look at crab pot harvest, where in this scenario, it's the complete opposite. With a few exceptions, we out harvest Maryland in crab pot harvest. So the rest of that, as you'll see in the table version of this, comes from their trot line harvest. Now, Maryland has also been running since 2008 a harvest estimate based on an effort survey and then some catch rates that they get from certain areas. So they put this together and do a survey estimate that you can see is the purple line saying that they think for whatever reason their harvesters are more or less over-reporting harvest in the years that they've been running the two together, although somehow, what was that, 2012, they were right on target. But overall, I found it interesting, you know, that so much of their Maryland's harvest, about 40% of their harvest is coming from trotline right now. So that's the reason why we outperform them in crab pot harvest, and yet, you know, overall they have a higher harvest level than Virginia. So that was just a quick run through of some of the stuff that we've got in hand now.
But your harvest levels are in pounds, right?
Yeah.
Is it pounds? Yeah. Well, they do a lot of male harvesting, which the males are larger than our females, so the pounds are going to be heavier than ours.
Yeah.
So that gives you an idea that Maryland is about 24 million pounds in 2014. What's the crop line now? About half, isn't it?
40%. They were saying on average. So, I don't have it specific. So.
Wayne, you had a question.
You have a question. If you figure in how many class A can fish and also can fish on Sundays, how does that equate with us?
If this is their crab pot, trot line's the other gear. So this is about half of their total. Okay. Yeah, that's what I wanted to hear.
My question was, if you figure in how many class A can fish,
and didn't they just open up earlier for the trot liners? Are they changing the regulation for that?
If they did, you should have received that information.
No, for Maryland.
I know, but if you did, you should have received that information, and along with it, Emily from NOAA said that she's going to update that data through 2015, so you'd have to look there.
Yeah, we have to.
This is for the coming season.
But Wayne has an interesting question, because we probably should look. I didn't know about the Sundays. Probably should look at the license category, get it from them, because they start at 300, and then they can have another person get up to 600, they can have two assistants and get up to 900. So we should probably, from the order of license category, be then
300, 600, 500 plots,
and then it might be worthwhile.
Figure out a path for
your fixed flow. That's a great, that is really good. We need to get that data too.
Error bars would be nice too on your data. On that data you said for the harvest data. Yeah, it's a number. But there is really error associated with every data.
So, yeah, I don't know that we have reporting estimates on reporting errors, but that I'm sure they do on their harvest estimates.
So I bet you'll find if you put error bars on this stuff, we're catching the same as them.
Well, there's no crab potting in the tributaries in Maryland. That's where all the trot line harvest is.
Yeah, as Rob pointed out, just by since this is just crab pot harvest, you know, in 2014, it was even closer to 50%. So they've been averaging about 40% of their harvest coming from the trot lines.
There's a lot of recreational trot lines. Is any of that reflected in any of these numbers up there? So this is just their commercial harvest.
That's one of the things you'll see is some of the comments on the TAC, and that's something that I've commented on again and again and again. You know, if NOAA's Chesapeake Bay office is talking about a total allowable catch, that would include what you allow the recreational harvest to be. I mean, that's, you know, the tax that we deal with at the federal management level for the ocean fisheries, they're under the Magnuson-Stevenson Act, and they have to account for everything, including dead discards that don't even make it to the dock, and absolutely, obviously, including the recreational fisheries. I mean, you couldn't imagine a tack in summer flounder or striped. Well, they don't manage striped bass, but summer flounder or sea bass.
You know, recreational crabbers in Maryland go.
They go
after it hard, trot line.
And they don't have very good estimates, nor do we or Potomac River, around what kind of harvest is happening in the recreational fishery. And I don't see how you go forward without somebody doing some kind of estimates or stuff.
What they do is they use 8%. Static for a number of years, 8%. Recreational baywide is 8%, and because Maryland doesn't allow female crabs from crab pots, then they have even less overall in the recreational. And what Pete is saying, there were two studies done by the National Marine Fisheries Service, historical studies, you know, in the 80s and the 90s, that's historical. And one study showed that the recreational fishery was a little bit more powerful than the commercial fishery in Maryland. Really did. The other one showed the recreational fishery was about 65%. So there's no doubt that Maryland has a bigger recreational fishery than Virginia, although we only have one piece of data, and that's 2001. And that survey, when we were done with it, we were told by ODU, this is just a first-order estimate. This is just sort of, you know, throw it up and stick on the wall. So, but... No, that's one of the weak parts of the management. The other show that I'm talking about a little bit, it's not catch, it's harvest. All the crabs that, and you know, I'm starting to get revved up with bad memories here, but all the harvest that takes place is assumed no discards. I mean, we met with Marilyn Rick Robbins, who's with me. Jack Travelstead was with me about 7 years ago. And they were, what? Discards? Dead discards? No, no way. And we're like, wait a minute, how about the pot fishery in the summer? How about the peeler fishery in the spring? The green crab, everything else. Yet the scientific community has run away from coming up with some estimates of discard mortality. They've got to put the pictures.
They have to, actually, yeah.
So, I mean, there's three aspects of the stock assessment that, and the management that are missing.
Mr. Powers?
So I looked on her sheet that was the one I think that Emily did, and it doesn't have anything about opening times, or I didn't see it. I could have missed it. So I'd heard about this, and from a conservation equivalency, if they are changing their hours that they can crab, then we should know about it so that you can talk to your peer, whoever that is now, about how they're what they're doing for conservation equivalency. I think it was a bill in the legislature that I'd heard about it. The reason I'd heard about it, because it only applied to commercial trotliners, and it didn't apply to recreational trotliners, and there's a big grump because the commercial guys will go in and take over a river, and then the recreational guys can't come out till 2 hours later, and all the good spots are taken, which is a whole separate issue. But the point is, if they're opening it up early and giving them more hours, and it's that big of a part of the fishery, then they have to give back somewhere else, I would think.
So you're not talking about earlier in the season, but earlier,
In the day.
Time limits aren't on here.
Well, I don't think anything exists right now to make conservation equivalent. The last thing that occurred in the joint agreement was 10% reduction of a couple of years ago.
Okay, so what you're saying to these men and women at this table is that if Maryland opens up their fishery and allows them to harvest more by doing rule changes, then more for Maryland, less for us?
Not necessarily. So we backed off on our season for years other than the crab pot in 2015. We might back off a little bit more this year, depending on the abundance. I think the idea is, if you don't do a wholesale change, taking what was conservation, you know, conservation measure, and really just downgraded it, then the jurisdictions have that some ability to manage. I think that's what it's all about. I mean, I will ask about that particular situation and find out how extensive they expect that to be. But it's not a wide open. There's an agreement among the Bay jurisdictions because we're all held by the reference points. We had a change with our sanctuary area last year. It went into effect this year. So it was a northern part of our sanctuary, they're going to be open June, or they're going to be going until June 1, and then it closes. And the lower part changed earlier and all that. We tried to do conservation equivalent to there, if you remember Ron's presentation.
And it could be that what they've done is in this bill is said it opens earlier and closes earlier. I don't know.
All right, Joe, are you ready for agents?
Yeah, I don't have a lot for you. But, so we're just, you know, we're back to the table, and I think I had a couple questions last time, and I think I've got the two that I wrote down answered. So. We pointed out that, you know, we did reach our cap. There was actually, I think, a couple extra medical exemptions. 77 of those reported harvest in 2015. 72 out of those that asked for an agent, the agent also had a commercial card. That was one of the questions that was asked at the last meeting. That's one of the two that we answered, and then we did do kind of categories. So the thing you have to realize about agents working, they report as the crabber. So I can't actually tell you when did the license holder, if he crabbed for a little while, got hurt, got an agent. I can't break that out. A lot of folks that ask for an agent aren't planning on crabbing at all that year. You know, I think we all know that. So you can see that the highest categories in either 2014 or 2015 are the smallest amount of days, and there's only literally a handful of people that used an agent that might have crabbed 150 or up to 200 days.
So this is total, sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
So this is total number of days landed on that license because you can't break out. Thanks.
Any questions for Joe? So basically, it's just a continuation of our discussion from last meeting. Anybody has any additional thoughts or comments?
It's been an unusual situation because the 2012 license are still the ones that have first call on agents, or if those 2012 licensees transfer to the CFRL and that license somewhere else, they have first call as well. I don't know whether Joe had it, but I think he had it last year, but, you know, only about 58 of the 125 last year were 2012 licensees, and so there seems to be a shift now where more, I'll call them new licensees are getting agents, and it gets down to the point where about four or five last year were just irate that they couldn't get an agent. So it's a shifting baseline for the agents. I'm not sure that 2012, what the intentions of the commission was, and I think it started at 168, and then it went down. I mean, I don't know how the committee feels, but I think this year we just wait. It's past March 1st, and where are the forms in? Everyone's in. So we're going to close out. I don't think we're going to learn very much about how to advise you on less agents, what criteria, it's kind of a different situation with the agents.
These are just crabbing agents.
Yes.
Do you have many agents that are used in other fisheries, gill netting, or?
They're not required, and the only reason why we're able to do this back to 2009 for crab agents is because they actually have to come in and fill out a form and ask to be an agent. We don't have that for other feeder types.
Mr. Powers, did you have a question?
No.
Okay, sorry.
I could repeat speech number 43.
which is state law says you cannot transfer your right to harvest commercially with the $200 license or whatever it costs now that you buy from the state. That license is not transferable. That's what state code says. I'm sorry, it's in state code, period.
43.
Again, it depends on how you interpret the code until our Attorney General's office tells us there's a problem. And they never have because everyone has an MRC ID. You have to figure out what's really being transferred.
What I am saying is contrary to state code is the ability to harvest and market seafood is controlled by that state code section, and it says you cannot transfer that right that you buy when you get your commercial waterman's card. Permits are a whole other matter. That's all the agency's decision.
I will indulge you.
I'll send you an email with some specifics.
Do you understand how they've the loophole, how they've gotten around this? Because I brought this up to the commission a couple of years ago, and knowing what I know about how the entry system was supposed to work back in 1994, I had the wonderful occasion to go out one morning, spring before last, and a guy with the buoys marked identical to mine had set all in amongst my crab pots. And I'm out there at the edge of daylight, and I hook this pot, and I throw it in the puller, and it gets about halfway up, and I look at the buoy, and I go, well, that's not my buoy. It's got a number on it. My number is 628. This guy's number was 9,000 and something. And I said, well, what the heck kind of an entry system do we have in this state where we've got 9,000 people? I called Rob or Jack or somebody, and it was explained to me, and I know what code says, that what they do is they, when there's a transfer of license, they retire one number and issue another one.
So that's a transfer of the number?
No. They retire the number and issue another
one. But they did not have to.
Listen, you don't have to explain it to me. I'm as upset about this as anybody. So what this tells me is over 20 years, although we have a fairly stable number of licenses over that period of time, they've churned 6,000 or more people through the system in and out. Now, that's not beneficial to anybody except the people that got in. The intent was at one time to allow a waterman to dispose of his fishing equipment when he decided he was going to quit,
yes,
whether he was going to retire. It gave him some value to his equipment. So the rule was supposed to be that you sell everything, or at least you sell your boat with the license. But if you look on the VMRC website or Craigslist or anywhere, you'll see these cards for sale by themselves and individual licenses. So it's become a commodity just like in any other commodity. Now, I don't think that's right, but I think Rob has the correct answer until you can get a ruling from the Attorney General, or you can figure out some way to give a waterman some way to dispose of his equipment when he decides to retire other than carrying it to the scrapyard. Then we've got sort of a dilemma.
You know, we run into a problem that one time with Jack Travels did. I bought a license from Tangier. Guy only had one boat. If he sold his boat, he sold his car. It's the only means of transportation he's got to get back and forth. So that's one thing you're looking at, you know? But I don't know what the answer is either.
If state code should be changed if you're going to do it. That's all I can say.
Rob's going to look into that.
There's already a cap.
Mr. Cox?
There's already a cap.
Just finish it.
Yeah.
If there are not any other questions, I've got a question in the audience if we're finished with the committee. Go ahead, Mr. Sanford.
Yeah, my question is this. I mean, evidently there is a problem with agents in certain areas. In certain areas, there are not problems. I mean, wouldn't it, I don't even know if it's possible, but possibly make it so you can't have an agent in a tributary that's only allowable in the mainstream of the Chesapeake Bay? Because there's a problem with the tributary.
Rob, do you have a response?
Don't look at me.
Yeah,
I got one guy that's got a system. So right now you're allowed a different pot limit in the tributaries, and you have more pots in the bay. So, you know, it just depends how urgent an issue that is.
And that's what it is. Just one.
And we have to have some information about the congestion in the tributaries, which is more than just anecdotal information.
We have to start looking at
where harvesters were at certain times to prove the anecdotal information. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's good.
Virginia Beach is a classic area, and even now, I mean, I hate to say it, but Chesapeake Beach State Park is a problem where there is congestion.
Yeah, and park is
strong for the conditions of tourism as far as possible.
Yeah, now we're going to hold the residents off.
You know,
back where the cages
are. What are they saying?
Mark, I guess the next step is to ask each committee if they want staff to isolate agent use according to the area. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, absolutely.
License holder.
I think Mr. Moore and then Mr. Powers. You're good, Mr. Powers.
So my concern with this, Mark, with this Tom Powers, would be the issue of what I feel is legitimate use of agents, which I think there are two. One of them, Doug, as an example, his son or grandson is an agent on his license to get into the industry, but he has a waterman's card. But the real issue, I think, is you have somebody like Tig was talking, how he had an agent that he got every year so he could go on vacation. And it's not a long term, I'm going to be out there for 6 months, but.
You know, 2 weeks, you know, you're taking a 2 week vacation. I'd love to do that. You know, but I mean, I just don't do it. I do it in February. But I think there is a way to look at this. Well, we obviously come up with a solution to make this work.
I used to send a boy to work for me with my little boy.
All right.
Can I ask one question?
Yes.
Is that in 2015, 72 of them had a commercial card that was agents?
Yes.
Is that off the 125?
Yeah, off the 125.
So it's you're looking at 50 that doesn't have a commercial card? I don't think they should be using somebody's preferred card.
And I think that's one of the reasons why the question was asked.
Yeah, good point. All right, if we're finished with questions here, there was one question in the audience, and I can't see her. Okay.
Now,
yes, ma'am.
Actually, comments. One has to do with what you just said, that out of the 125 agents that were allowed, 72 had for commercial fishing, had a whole value. Can you go back to the other slide?
Yep.
This
one does have a valid card.
And this one, you know, would explain in some way. In some way, why so many of them are working 75 days or fewer, even though that's everybody, not just the agents, but the commercial fishermen too. If people are actually doing it for short-term vacations, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, you know, whatever, to help out, we don't know that. And the other thing you don't know is how many of those people are family members, as we heard about earlier. We don't know how many, if you go back to the other slide, there's a lot of issues here that are, have been touched on about, you know, having a family member who's helping you because you're not able to do it completely by yourself. I can't imagine who that might be. But, you know, that may very well be a lot of the 72. A family member who has a commercial license and is helping a family member who needs physical help.
Well, that was the intent of the whole thing to begin with. It was supposed to be a temporary situation if you had an illness, some sort of something that you had to take care of, if you wanted to go on vacation, but you had an obligation to a buyer to keep on working. And it got turned into, over the years, to where it was like the scallop fleet, where you could buy a boat and hire a captain and go about your other business. It really became a problem back crab dredging. You remember how that fishery exploded back before we put a number limit on it. We had people buying boats and putting all kinds of people out there because they had enough money to buy a boat.
But if you look at that first slide back on the other slide, there's
Well,
you know,
so,
a few people, I mean, look under what it says number of crabbers, under 10 down there that are doing it.
30 days.
Agents that are doing it full-time. And there's very few that are doing it 150 to 200 days. A handful.
Well, a lot of people will use them just on the initial peeler run.
So there's all kinds of other information that we don't know that affects some of these numbers that are probably legitimate.
Yeah, it's already capped. It's capped. I don't understand the issue. Yes. Every time, yeah.
Well, Wayne, like I said, that was the initial intent, but it turned into people buying a boat to put an agent on the boat. They never intended on ever even going on the boat.
But it's probably not that many of them. What you're talking about is having, like, you can have an agent up to 60 without
accounting. Yeah, there are more agents out there that work in boats.
Yeah. Right.
What I like about this system is it's cut and dry. I can't tell you whether 125 is the right number, but when it's done, it's done. Agents in our regulation don't require a CFRL. I'm not sure why that's a big sticking point. An agent can be anyone. So in gill netting, with any other type of fishery, it can be anyone. We obviously have to tell you more about the impacts. I think Mark brought up a good question. Committee's interested in staff pursuing that. I think that's a good question because we hear a lot about the tributary, the tributaries being congested, and if we can kind of figure out where the agents are or in what part of the season, that might be something worthwhile to think about. But originally it was medical, yes, and military leave, active military duty, but that went by the books a long time ago, and now. What I worry about is there are probably about 40 of our CFRO holders who may have pretty good reasons to get really upset if we decide to make advice to the commission that we don't need agents. I think we're beyond that. I think we need to be agents. I think each time you can come up with a better reason as to why we either want to change the current system, that's fine.
Mr. Powers?
My comment is not, or general beef, or however you want to say it, is not with the concept of having agents. It's with the concept of having someone who is not a licensed commercial waterman work as an agent. That's the issue. I don't think it should be just the crab fishery. I think it's across the board.
crab fishery is just where we're dealing with it now.
Mr. Jenkins.
I mean, you have the same thing, no agents in the black sea bass fishery or something.
Mr. Jenkins? You don't have to come all the way up.
We just got a report from Maryland and Nahal, and I think we have a problem down here with the advisory board and other things on this thing with the agent. Okay. Every regulation you put in, to try to change it, please this person, or that person, or the other person. One thing, you take away the right to say through warm or well. And the other thing is, to this thing that the gentleman brought up on the phone, tributaries or the bay. So, you know, some people who might be a resident of the area for 20 years is great. And for some reason or another, his family wanted to move or something else, and he moved to another area in the bay. He's been buying license for 20 years, resident of Virginia all his life, and then that happened to be on a tributary or whatever, and that's going to say, well, he can't pay you. So you got to look at people, you know, right, legal rights. And the other thing is, this is going to add a little humor to it, the low crab has passed away and I have James out of control for it. The first year they put in that registration for commercial waters, he went down to Heathfield to get his license. And he went in there, and of course, he was getting his age, and he was around 85. And he went in there to get his verified license. And they said, well, before you get your verified license, you got to get a registration license to buy his verified license. And man, he raised his hand. He said, you mean to tell me that I got to buy this before I can buy my license that I've been buying for, you know, like 6 to 5 years? And, they said, yeah, that's right. He said, but it's going to help you. You buy this one license, and you're not going to have to buy any other license or anything else. You just buy this restoration license, and it'll be good. And what it will help you is that other people won't get around you and set the spot. And he said, well, if it's that damn good, I want two of them.
I knew that was coming.
Mr. Nixon.
One other question, Rob. And it, you said that you like this because it has a fixed number. The problem with it is now is that it's gone away from the original intent. Now, if you have a situation where you have a father and son, and they each have two boats, and just like Jamie and I have a boat and she has a boat, say something happens to one of us. What you know, that's going to be short term, and the agent number is already used up. What do you do about a temporary situation about the gear that's in the water?
Yeah, there's a couple things we need to clear up. One was any crab gear needs an agent, and so all those are in. It's not just crab pot. It's, the numbers are for all gears. And the other is that cap. We could exceed that cap through hardship only. It's on a case-by-case basis that would go through the commissioner's or his proxy.
There's five that have gone that way.
Yeah. But we at least put that in when we did this, that if somebody needed to get that gear out of the water, and they could show that they could.
Well, how about if they wanted to leave it in the water and work it intermittently with their other gear if it's crab pots? Don't know?
That's not the way it is right now. No, I mean, you know, the hardship is a medical hardship, so I...
Well, you know, I'm just going to – this hasn't happened, but I'm going to give you a hypothetical. My mother-in-law is 92. Jamie's 61. She's spent a lot of time taking care of her mother, but she still wants to work some. Now, if her mother ends up going into an emergency situation where Jamie's got to stay at home with her for several days or a couple weeks, but we need the income off of that gear – even more then, because you're liable to have to hire somebody else. I almost took offense at what you said the other day about things being from back in the 80s and 90s being historical, because that would make Doug and me and several others in this room here prehistorical. and I'm starting to appreciate more and more every year a lot of the things that Doug brings up. And I guess, you know, experience and time brings a little more wisdom. Sometimes it doesn't, though, you know. But how do you overcome that with this type of system? The whole thing was supposed to be to help out in particular situations. It might not even particularly be a hardship. Just like Wayne said, maybe you get an opportunity to go on a trip, but you can't afford to have everything sit idle, or you don't have any place to store it ashore, you know, temporarily. This is what this was supposed to do. And now it's morphed into this hire a captain for the whole season, and if something really legitimate comes up where you need somebody else on the boat, you've got to leap this hurdle. You know, is a vacation a hardship? Maybe that's the only time of the year you can afford to go. You know.
Well, last year, my wife got sick, and I had to take her to treatments for about 6 weeks. And I asked for a hardship case with Rob, and he granted my son to be an agent. Now, when I couldn't work and had to take her to treatments, my son was my agent and worked on the boat. And maybe 1 or 2 days a week that she didn't have treatment, I could do it. And it worked out just right for that certain amount of time that I needed to get through that.
Right.
That's the way that worked. But if you have a cap on it, or if you have all these, what I'm saying is all these other things here is going to block you. You know, we didn't put these living in the land of the free.
But you know better than that.
Sometimes we are our own enemies. And Maryland up there got 900 bucks to fish on Sunday. Look, I don't want to fish on Sunday.
So last year, the intention was, big discussion last year about stopping the agents and not having agents. And I said, okay, you're all fired up about agents, that's fine. Let's do that, but let's at least put out a notice so those who do have agents can come and meet at the same time. That never happened. And then the last go round, more or less, the committee threw up its hand and said, well, okay, 125 is good, leave it there. Staff would do anything to support the committee, majority of the committee, as to what you want to do. But it's your advice to the commission that counts as a separate recommendation. But in this case, staff's been right along with you the whole time. If you have a way that you want this to be shaped, you know, we'll be there too with the advice to back that up. And I think we spent a lot of time on this, especially since 2005. So about in our 11th year, at least talking about it each year. And what do you think you need from staff to make sort of a finality to this agent situation? What do you need to know from us?
Got a question, Mr.
If this is a real definite need, or is it something that was created by the ability to do this? Does that make any sense?
Yes, it does.
Mr. Tanker?
What I hear sometimes about agents, and I think something we need to be thinking about is, and I think that it goes with these numbers up here, you've got agents when the market's hot. Agents go away when the market's not any good. And their agents are hammering the people who are in the marketplace for the long term. That's what I hear in Cape Charles. And people point at the agents and say, this is the reason we got too many crabs and price goes down. The agents are here. They're going to go away when price goes down.
Well, that's what I was talking about. People use them on the, you know, the May peeler run.
Yeah, same thing.
And then after the main run is over, then
you're gone.
They're gone.
Mr. Cox?
Mr. Tanker covered it then.
Okay, thank you. So you're set.
And I think the numbers are with you, with us on that. The agents show up for a short period of time.
I,
Mr. Powers?
Something everybody has to catch about this graph that he said, just to remind you, to correct you.
Sure.
That is not what the agent is doing. That is what everybody who fishes on that particular license did.
Right.
So it could be that Pete got an agent permit, or Ty got an agent permit, and he worked 175 days that year, and his agent worked 14 of those when he went on vacation. But he gets an agent every year. He was here last meeting, I think. He gets an agent every year, and it's one of his crew who is a licensed commercial waterman, and he gets it just so he has it in the bag in case he needs to take a day off. He can just say, you work the rig today, and the two other people on his crew get paid that day. And I think that's a fine approach. That's a reasonable thing to do. My only beef is the commercial waterman part. Well, except for the crab fishery, you have this issue, and I think it also could probably be said for other fisheries where they're making use of non-licensed individuals, where people will just go out looking for day laborers, effectively smart day laborers, to go work their gear for them.
Rob?
Well, I guess, why don't you...
Is there any way you could require somebody to delineate that on their reports?
Yes.
Why don't you work together... would be to get started with a cap, not on the number of people, but on the number of days, times, however you want to do it. I mean, you know, like Pete's suggestion or Pete's situation, when an agent might be needing an emergency. Well, how long is that emergency? How long is that vacation? How long is, in other words, it seems like that's where we started. Through the public hearing process, we find out where that ends. Does it end with no one can have an agent for more than 2 weeks? Do you have to have special consideration? I would think so. I mean, I'm happy to sign off on, as a designated commissioner, on a need basis for agents. It'd be a lot less signatures than I've done for commercial registration licensees who got in because of exceptions. That's the kind of way I hope you'll think about this, but I'm not sure you can nail it down right now. But it does come down to, instead of quantity, it comes down to need.
Well, that was the original intent of the whole thing. As I've told this committee before, this is my fault. I take all the blame.
Well, I need to research where it started to fall apart. I mean, I was here, and there were incidences where it definitely, there was enough pressure to...
Well, this started back before the card.
Yeah, this fell apart 2 years after it was done.
Well, this started because the code used to read on crab licenses that the license had to be in the name of the operator of the boat.
Licensee, yes.
Not the mate. In other words, if I was the crabber and I wanted to let my boat be run by my son one day while I'm in the back culling crabs and a patrol officer pulled up to me, I could get a ticket.
Yes.
Because he was operating a boat and he didn't have a license. And what happened was Ronnie Reed had to do something one day and he crabbed in the morning and sent for a while and then sent the boy back out to finish crabbing. He had an appointment or something, and the boy got a ticket. And we had it changed back then that somebody could, and crabbing was the only thing that was that exception. The boy could take his dredge boat. He could fish his gill nets. The only thing he couldn't do was crab pots. So we had that delineated from that, and that was the end of it. And then when the card came about a couple of years later, then this agent thing came up. And that's where the change occurred.
Yeah,
and then with what Tom was talking about, with the transferability of the cards, and people were buying cards, and then they'd hire somebody to do it, it's just incrementally crept up to where you have people that hire people to run their boats for.
Mr. Moore.
Because we do talk about this every year, and we spent a tremendous amount of time. Maybe, Rob, based on the fact that you grant the agent, you sign off on the medical hardships, Could you maybe bring back to us some things that we might could look at in terms of what a regulation might look at? Maybe if it's for less than 2 weeks, you just have to register with the commission. If it's longer than 2 weeks and it's medical hardship, you sign off on it. Just some things to get us thinking about a way to put this in regulation other than just the number.
I don't think there's anything that I can bring to you that you don't already have at your disposal, because most of you are involved with the fishery itself. And I think you know medical's going to be in there. Military is still going to be in there, which it was before after the military. And then you have to consider perhaps some time. I just threw out 2 weeks as just an example, because people talk about a vacation. It could be longer depending on the circumstances. What I'm a little leery of is, if this is sort of wide open, how many licensed crabbers will say, hey, I got a 2 week period, I'm going to write for an agent. And then all of a sudden, I have Solomon again, which I did for 3 years, on deciding the veracity of what people are telling you. I mean, so we need a little more work, but I don't have anything more
than to
the
box. I mean, as far as how that would work, I'll look. I mean, I'll look into it.
Thank you.
All right.
So next meeting.
We've been sure we'll talk about it again next meeting.
But I think it's something that we really need to figure out.
Criteria as you go through here. I mean, I think if we play this back and listen to this.
Same conversation.
You probably would hear a lot of the pieces fall out.
Mr. Moore?
Joe, you mentioned that we could change the reporting form to allow. Does that take an act of the commission? I'm assuming that would take an act of the commission, and then we probably couldn't institute. No?
No.
So
we can just notify those individuals that use agents, since we have that list.
Okay.
On a way to demark that on the form when the agent's being used.
That's the 125 people you know have an agent. I would suggest that if you're going to put it on the form, you put it on the form, period. What you want to know is, I mean, what if I were commissioner, what I would want to know is what the industry I am trying to regulate looks like. And part of what the industry looks like that the commission regulates and that we advise on for crabs is the use of agents as labor for a business model. And I don't think that's the intent. I think the intent of Virginia law is the individual businessman waterman model, and not somebody who just leases out a boat and gives them their license to go fish.
I think you're talking about a lot of expense, though, and reprinting of forms and everything.
Maybe it's something we can phase in next year.
Well, wait a minute. You've never filled out a report. The first thing you have to do is write your number down there on the report. It's not printed on there for you. So all you have to do is put an A behind it if you've got an agent using your thing. It would be as simple as that. Changing a bunch of forms.
That's fine.
For any day that you used an agent. You have to fill one of these out for every day. So just fill it out, your number. Put an A behind it that day. If the next day the agent doesn't go, don't put an A on. And then they can, I'm sure you can pick that up, can't you?
All right, are we ready to move on? Last item on the agenda?
We do this every year.
Okay. Initiate a discussion of possible management responses to the late April, early May results of the 2015-16 Baywide Winter Crab Dredge Survey.
I think we've talked about this
a couple
of times, as well as tonight, and this is just sort of to figure out what your response might be to the measures we have if the abundance comes back very good on the spawning age females, or very good on the juveniles, or very good on both, and then take that and turn it around. Since no one really has the numbers yet, we know that it may be that one
of those stages is doing well and one is not. And again, we're all about this idea that the juveniles recruit into the fishery in late summer, fall. And I think we saw that with the data that Joe showed you, so that we have to pay attention to the juveniles, which we never did really seriously, as far as their spawning capabilities the subsequent May or July, August. So everything's all intertwined with spawning possibilities. That's why we have the reduced bushel limits in March. That's why we have the reduced bushel limits in November, so the juveniles that have grown and matured can pass through and not run quite as much of a gauntlet towards the next spring. I mean, that's the whole idea there. But, I mean, I can tell you that in our estimation, sustainability matters. It's a word that's used quite a bit, but I don't think 1 year after you look at these numbers here for 2015, 411 total crabs, I don't think that makes sustainability right away. It was better, but above this gray shaded line, I don't know if you can see my finger there or not, but above here, what I asked for was to look at all the years where we really had good production, just total crabs. And the years are mixed up here because these are sorted by the highs to the low. And what always flabbergasts me is look at all those crabs in 1993, a tremendous Bay-wide harvest. You know, that's when we had 50 million pounds. And we just inched over the female exploitation rate, just barely over this 34%. Here we're right on it. A lot of crabs here. And it's, when do you want to take your crabs? If you have high abundance of the spawning age females, then you're going to do well in spring and summer. If you have high juveniles, this is a pretty high amount of juveniles here, the 340, pardon me, 476, you're still going to end up doing very well. In 2005, and I may have goofed up the year, CBSAC met, and they were worried about what they were going to tell the jurisdictions about low harvest, because there were low harvests from, God, probably 1999 down to 2008. And there was also overfishing for 8 of 11 years. So they formulated a policy that there should be 200 million males and females crabs for the age 1 plus. And they also noted that that was because that seemed to give good recruitment, new production the next year, and pretty good harvest, which ranged from 65 to 75 million pounds. And you can see here all the years where there was good harvest, exploitation was fairly low, abundance was fairly high, all above 450 million. So I would suggest that as a starting point, we wait and see what we come back with. I think we've got to do better than this, but you know, certainly this is a time where in these years that you're seeing pretty good amount of juveniles and a very, you know, pretty good amount of spawning age females. And to me, if we put the clock forward and said this is 2016, 17, and 18, I would say, you know what? With the short lifespan of a crab, where the average age of a crab out there is about 1.6 years, something's been achieved here. We have some steadiness to the abundance and to the harvest. So now, a lot of this is going to change because there is less effort. I mean, there is less effort than we had back in these years. We had a lot more effort. But we need to know more about the effort. What Joe showed you with the trip data, we need to dissect that a little bit. That's the closest we can get to catch per unit effort, is at the trip level. The ideal amount would be the pot level. but, you know, our reporting of pots used and everything else is not real good. Not real good. So I think all you need to do is have seen this and let that stick with you a little bit. And then we probably should all get together. You know, we'll send you the results as soon as we get them, you know, for the Baywide Winter Dredge Survey results. And then we should plan on getting together very shortly thereafter. We have until, you know, that's going to be probably early May. I'd like it to be late April, but I can't promise that. That's up to people. But, you know, we have to have the regulation done at the June meeting at the latest. And that's kind of cutting it close, but you know, I think that's the way it's going to end up. So the things to think about before we meet again are, depending on what the abundance is, where are the areas that can be, I'll say, relaxed if it's good abundance? And how much do you really think relaxation should be, given the fact that since 2011, we really haven't had a high amount of spawning age females. As a matter of fact, we're not doing too well down here. In 2014, that was bad, and that's not terrific. So it does come down to, you know, that type of information for you. I don't think anyone should worry about the exploitation rate if it's not been finished yet. And that's my advice, to just think about it. Now, it's not just your committee. It's many committees. There's always a hurry-up at the last minute. I don't mind if you have questions to get in touch. You know, we all have email connection. You've got email connection with Joe and the rest of the staff as well. If you have things that come up that you think will help by the time we meet next, let me know. You know, generally, it's human nature to wait and then kind of do that hurry-up thinking. But, you know, it'd be good if you want to have anything beforehand. And if you have proposals, and if you have scenarios where you say, look, if we've got good abundance, I really think we should do this. We should. So here's what I've heard tonight so far. We should allow the peeler potters to have more pots. I mean, I wouldn't agree with 250. I would think, you know, they lost 30%. They should get back to where crab pots are at 15%. Can we do that? We probably should really look seriously at a December 15th fishery again, and maybe even a little more. I mean, who knows? This is all predicated on the abundance of it, right? We probably should discuss these smaller gear types. I mean, I think the crab pot is like 94% of the total harvest, maybe 95%. So how about these other gear types? Should they be held to a little longer season, get a longer season, a benefit out of that? I mean, those are the things that come off the top of my head, and you'll have ideas too. So. I really appreciate you being here tonight. I know that Lynn may have some other things to let you know, but you know, this has been good. And the allocation, the only thing I can tell you about allocation is we do have to prepare as if it could happen, despite the fact that there's a lot of different areas say we don't want it to happen. Okay.
Thank you, Rob. I think I've discussed everything I had. And new business, so if we have a motion to adjourn, unless anybody else.
When's the next meeting? Do we know?
I think we're going to set out an email.
In May.
We're going to try and find out, it's almost like being a spy, to find out what might be the time that data may come out. And then we'll try and get that meeting so close to when that data comes out. And we'll also send it to you by email.
Just keep in mind that May might be, you know, sort of a hectic time. You know, long.
Mr. Sanford. Yes, Mr. Sanford?
Yeah. You know, I don't know if anybody's aware of this or not, but we're having a few issues in Virginia Beach in the Windhaven area, and then recently at the Chesapeake State area pertaining basically user conflict. And I just want you to be basically aware of that. You know, what they're trying to do in Virginia Beach is to have a big discussion about oysters, but the word I have basically is, you know, they're also going to talk about crab potting in the Windhaven River. And at the Chesapeake area, what they're trying to do is basically exclude crab pots from a certain area around the ferry dock. So, I mean, you know, I don't want to go ahead and talk about that.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. There is a study group that the commissioner is working on, and that information has been provided, and there are those individuals out there.
It's a bait and beach.
Think that some commercial fishing activities really aren't what should be next to where they live and everything else. But that's going to be probably more than a couple of meetings. We have one commission member who will be on that panel, and the commissioner, of course, has been working hard on it. Our leasing department has been working on it, and you know, it's one of those things that we hope it turns out the way it should.
Right. You know, and really my question is this. I mean, we've got the sanctuary.
Hang on.
He's gone. I know what he was getting ready to say. We have the sanctuary outside down there, and what that does when it closes, it forces everybody in the river or up the river somewhere. And those folks at Lincoln Bay and Little Neck Creek, they call it, they don't want anybody doing anything. And with this oyster cage issue down there, in the discussion, the crab pot density issue has been brought up too. So,
Rob, do we have anybody representing the crab pot industry on that, in that group?
I haven't seen the list yet. I know that you have John, Ben Stagg, and I think the best thing to do is if you'd be able to ask John.
Certainly.
Suggest to John, probably.
Okay.
That might be good.
Thank you.
We're having the first meeting that I've got to go to tomorrow night. And it's a Civic League meeting in Allenton. And Ben Stagg is going to be there to present that group. I guess he's going to give them a slideshow or whatever, a general presentation of how the leasing works. But those folks are going to be in a panic about 2 days from tomorrow when the whole place fills up with crab pots.
Mr. Cox?
Nothing else. I'll make a motion to adjourn.
Meeting adjourned.
We need a second.
You got a second.
About a half hour. Okay.